All rise.
The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning. We are here today on case 11-1172, Beth Miller versus Norman Miller. For the cross appellant, Mr. Warnock.
Thank you and good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor and justices. May it please the court, my name is Douglas Warnock. I, along with co-counsel Matthew Warnock, represent Rebecca Miller, the cross appellant. With the court's permission, I reserve 3 minutes of time for rebuttal. The issue before the court this morning is important and straightforward. It's important because it directly affects thousands of persons in Delaware County who have been divorced during the past 10 years and untold numbers of other litigants across the state in both domestic relations and civil cases. The issue is straightforward in that it considers the effect of a defective signature on a judgment entry and whether that defective signature under Civil Rule 58A renders the judgment voidable or void.
Some of the discussions we've had in a lot of the voidable issues on like post-conviction relief have involved the fact that it may not be discovered for a long time. In this case, you have an entry. You clearly can look at the entry the day you get it within the 30-day appealable time and make a decision whether you accept the timestamp version or the robo version, whatever you want to call it, versus the actual version. So why wouldn't that, because it's an easily discoverable issue that both parties have an opportunity to find out within 30 days, why shouldn't that just be a voidable matter?
It is our contention, Your Honor, that it should be voidable. That is the whole point of this particular case, that it was very clear that the magistrate who signed the final divorce decree signed it rather than the judge. She put her initials there, so she marked it.
In this case, there was no one calling from the other side saying, this is not a valid signature, you have to have the judge sign it. Nobody raised that issue in those 30 days that you had that document.
That's right. No one raised the issue for 3.5 years. And in addition to that point, the parties went back to court again. The final divorce decree was 2005. The parties agreed. It was an agreed entry. Then the parties went back in 2007 to adjust child support. Another agreed entry. And then 2 years after that, in 2009, for the first time, cross-appellee attacked by a 60B motion the original divorce decree. Rebecca Miller's cross-appellant's position in this case is very simple, that this court should reverse the decision of the Fifth District Court of Appeals and adopt the proposition of law that this court has accepted for review, which very simply says that a defective signature under Civil Rule 58A renders the judgment voidable, not void, subject to challenge on direct appeal, but not subject to collateral attack at some later time.
Mr. Warnock, what is your experience with magistrates signing the names of judges to documents with the authorization of the court?
My personal experience is limited to primarily Delaware County.
This case,
but this was a practice in Delaware County for approximately 10 years.
Do you know how pervasive the practice is across the state?
I can only respond anecdotally because as part of this preparation, I called as many counties as I could, lawyers or judges. Not many judges were willing to admit that they didn't sign their own orders. But lawyers were Lawyers were a little more forthcoming. And so it's probably more likely that some magistrates sign orders, but other people do, such as secretaries and law clerks and so forth. And there seems to persist this idea about rubber stamps. My experience goes back to the 1970s when municipal courts were making notations on case jackets and doing rubber stamps. And until we got this appeal, I thought that practice had kind of faded out, but it still seems to persist.
Well, isn't there a procedure, though, that once the recommendation is made by a magistrate and objections could be filed, then there's a period of time for the court to review that? And are we just sort of winking at that process here, or is this maybe peculiar and unique to a situation where the parties had all agreed to the terms?
In our county, with this particular trial court, the judge had authorized the magistrate to sign the agreed judgment entries. And so there probably was a winking at or a noncompliance with Civil Rule 53, the magistrate procedure. In an agreed judgment entry, of course, there is standard language almost everywhere, and certainly in our county, that says the parties are waiving the period to file objections and waiving objections and so forth.
Okay.
And so it's not really a big problem in that Civil Rule 53 almost across the board is being complied with. And then, of course, in an agreed judgment entry, when the parties agree, they agree to waive the objection period, so there's not a violation of Civil Rule 53. I would not want to characterize this court that there's a pervasive violation of Civil Rule 53, that the courts are just doing away with that
procedure. Has the practice been changed in Delaware County, to your knowledge?
Absolutely, it has, Your Honor.
Because even with an agreed judgment entry, the court has ultimate responsibility for reviewing the entry and making sure it complies with the Ohio Revised Code. And so in this case, there was an agreed judgment entry. Everybody agreed to the terms. It was clear, I think, as one of my colleagues asked earlier, that the magistrate had signed it because she initialed it. And it wasn't until 3.5 years later that the decree is challenged. Is that right?
That's correct.
There was no contested issue for the judge to rule on.
That's right.
Okay.
And then, of course, again, in 2007, there was a post-decree proceeding for child support, and the parties agreed again and had an agreed entry signed again by the magistrate, but they agreed. And so there was no issue about whether or not someone lost out or didn't get some kind of right to object to the court.
Counsel, is this was a routine practice in Delaware County?
Yes, Your Honor.
As far as we are aware, that there was a judgment entry that was signed, judges named, handwritten by a magistrate. If we do not rule in your favor, what does this do for other cases similarly situated, having been signed by the magistrate on behalf of the judge? Does it open, you know, a Pandora's box, so to speak, of what could the result be here?
Pandora's box is a good use of a term. Chaos, it's a big mess. Honestly, it has created a great deal of uncertainty and confusion among persons who have been divorced. In this particular case, the ex-husband has died, and his estate is being probated, but it's being held up because potentially he has two surviving spouses. Every area of law is affected. And if the court considers family law, of course, there's child support. The worst case scenario is when someone has been remarried and then had children. Are those children born out of wedlock?
You say he has two surviving spouses.
I didn't say that. I said that. That's the question.
Okay. All right. Because both remarried.
Yes.
Okay. So the question, if the original divorce decree is invalid because of the signature dispute, then neither were free to remarry.
That's right. And so the question for probate is which spouse is the real surviving spouse. That affects inheritance, of course. It also affects family allowance, the living in the mansion house. It affects any children. We don't have any children born of this second marriage, but there are plenty out there. It affects real estate. In this case, there was a quitclaim deed. If there was a spouse, there was not a release of dower. There was also a mortgage deed. So in the refinancing, there wasn't a release of dower if there was a prior spouse.
Would it also not affect tax filings? for the years in question between the divorce, the remarriage, and subsequent joint tax filings, if there are any. So, you know, there is, and if this is compounded by other similarly situated judgment entries out there, cases with judgment entries, I can see the plight of domestic relation cases and clients being thrown into just utter confusion.
Our office, of course, is just one in Delaware County, but we have counted
you
about...
You might have a landslide business.
We have about 400 cases that might be affected by this. In the county, we've estimated there'd be roughly 4,000 cases that are potentially affected. And as you indicate, not only tax law, but, and I mentioned probate, estate planning, insurance questions.
This could open up lots of legal work if we don't agree with you, huh?
It's not legal work that we prefer to have, Your Honor. When a client has come back, as in the last few months, and said, I didn't get enough spousal support, I would like to get more. And it then becomes, frankly, a tough question for lawyers to answer, but also an ethical question. What are the ethical obligations to current clients, former clients, and then ones who come back and want to make misuse or take advantage of this situation? In this particular case, the only reason that this came up is because our side of the case was trying to enforce a property division order, and the attack back in defending that simply was, well, the divorce case was not valid. The problem is that we can't pick and choose in these cases the issues. We can't just say, okay, the divorce was invalid as to child support or spousal support or the division of the pension. It's an all or nothing situation, and so we don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater here and say, okay, the divorce then is undone. But that's, if the Fifth District Court of Appeals decision stands, that's what it will result in, that there is not a divorce and that all of these people over the past 10 years have their divorces open, subject to attack later. If the Court of Appeals below had followed its own precedent in the Fifth District and the precedent of this court in Lesher, it would have come to a different result, and it would come to the result that we hope that this court will determine. The common factors in this type of case are that there was a judgment entry with a defective signature. That defective signature could have been one that a magistrate did. It could have been one that was rubber stamped, could have been signed by a law clerk or a secretary. And then there was no direct appeal from that judgment entry. And then there was an acceptance of the judgment. The parties relied on it. They changed their lives around it. Remember, they're changing all of the most significant parts of their lives based on this.
Counsel, is the idea that the magistrate is not the court and constitutionally is not the court and has no jurisdiction to act? I'm interested to know if any of the arguments that were discussed with the Court of Appeals talked about our recent cases in the criminal scenario, broadening when a order is void instead of voidable.
The Court of Appeals did not discuss that, and one of the propositions of law that Cross-Appellee raised with this court that you declined to hear was something about the constitutional issue. Cross-Appellee will argue that there's a constitutional issue here. We submit to the court that there is not a constitutional issue. It's simply a matter of a signature. In the criminal arena, of course, you have a whole bunch of different rights. Here we're talking about civil cases, so that, I would repeat, especially with an agreed judgment entry, no one lost any rights. Parties didn't have any due process issues because they agreed on what the order would be. They waived any further hearings. They waived any magistrate's decision and objection. So I would suggest to the court that there's not a constitutional issue, and it's just a matter of the mechanics of signing the order. In that context, it really doesn't matter who signed the order, secretary or so forth.
Looking at the rule, which says the court shall promptly cause the judgment to be prepared and the court having signed it, do you find that there's any violation of the rule based on that language?
the rule says that the court shall sign the judgment entry. Mm-hmm. Nowhere in the law, statute, or civil rules does it say that the court is the judge. By judicial interpretation, courts of appeals have held that it has to be the judge personally signing. One proposition of law that we advanced that this court did not accept for review was talking about the signature. For purposes of our argument today, we are conceding and assuming that the signature of the magistrate on behalf of the judge was defective under Civil Rule 58A. And then we are asking the court to consider, and you've accepted the proposition of law, does that then render the judgment void or voidable? The Fifth District Court of Appeals made the mistake of coming to the wrong decision because they relied on the wrong precedents. All the precedents that the Court of Appeals relied on were ones that were on direct appeal as opposed to collateral attack. It's easy if a case is on direct appeal to say, okay, just send it back. Nobody's gotten remarried. Nobody's changed their positions. It's this no direct appeal, then collateral attack, relying on the judgment.
But how important is the fact that this was an agreed-upon entry, that it was not a contested, disputed situation?
The rule probably shouldn't be different, but it reinforces how unjust the Court of Appeals decision is for this particular case. And there is something not right, untoward, about someone agreeing and then three or so years later, or 5 years or 10 years later, saying, whoa, the court didn't sign it, so therefore I get out of it. It's not just and it's not fair.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Gaba.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Elizabeth Gaba, and I am here for Beth Miller Niece. And I want to first speak about whether or not it was clear to either of the parties that the signature on the decree of divorce, on the various documents which purport to be decrees of divorce, because there are a couple of them. In fact, now there are three of them because the judge just signed something as well pursuant to the Fifth District Court of Appeals opinion. He signed a document that essentially says, use this as my signature that I should have signed years ago.
Is that the nunk-pro-tunk?
That's what I'm calling a nunk-pro-tunk, yes. It's not actually a decree of divorce. It's an entry. I'm an attorney, and I didn't notice that the magistrate had signed the judge's name, and that's because, other than some of the other cases that we see where you have a rubber stamp of a judge's name by the magistrate and the magistrate signs his or her name in ink, you have the magistrate in this case signing the judge's name.
But there, you do have a slash and you have what looks like initials afterwards.
That's correct, and I also want to point out that typically in divorces, at least it's been my experience over many years, what happens is the original and copies are submitted to the court, mm-hmm. and what we get back are copies, typically with rubber stamped name of the judge, not an original signature of the judge, and the original is somewhere buried in the court file or on microfiche.
Do you practice regularly in Delaware?
I do.
Well, I'm looking at a signature that looks like it's his signature, not the slash, of Judge Kruger, and I'm looking at the one that has the slash with the initials, and they're not even close.
Not even close.
So there's, if you had any careful examination of the document, you would know this is not his signature.
But I'm not every day. I practice in Delaware, but I'm not every day in Delaware. My domestic cases are mostly in Franklin County and Fairfield County and other counties. I sat down one day while working on this case and looked at the entry again and said, wait a minute, that's not his signature.
Now, your client's remarried. Your client had remarried?
My client remarried. That's correct.
And if you pursued this position, what did you advise your client about the second marriage, that it was void?
Well, I don't think it's void because any impediment to the marriage is gone because Mr. Miller's deceased.
But what about all the rights that stem from being married to a second person, inheritance and everything else? They're gone. They don't exist. If this judgment entry is void, that everything that stems from that second marriage is gone.
But I think this judgment entry is void, and I understand that.
And if it's void, isn't anything that flows subsequent from it also void? The second marriage, inheritance, tax filings, all the things that the chief talked about are gone if this original foundational document is void.
I think they're voidable. Again, I think that any impediment to the second marriage is gone because of the decease of Mr. Miller.
Except the second marriage could not be deemed to have occurred if she didn't have the right to enter into the marriage contract. So Justice Stratton is correct. You can't have it both ways. You can't try to renegotiate the property settlement of the first marriage and say, well, somehow the second marriage survives. That marriage would be deemed void as well.
All right. I'll concede that. And I also want to point out something else. Mr. Warnock was
so
saying...
Your client would be happy to have this first marriage or the divorce be void, take some inheritance, and then have another wedding?
I would think so, yes. But I think that I also want to point out that there was some discussion about whether the parties had waived objections to the magistrate's decision, and they did not. That does not appear in the document. In the document that was originally a memorandum of agreement, that's not in the court file anymore, other than as an exhibit in pleadings that I filed. That document disappeared when it was altered, and I think 8 or 9 months later. The words memorandum of agreement were whited out and it became a judgment entry decree of divorce. There's nothing in the court file that says that the parties waived objections. And in fact, the Fifth District Court of Appeals said that there was not only a violation of Civil Rule 58, but there was a violation of Civil Rule 53. I understand that in State X Rel Lesher v. Kainrad, there's a discussion of, well, if there's a Civil Rule 53 violation, then what the people should do. And that appears in Beal versus Beal, which esteemed counsel has cited as well.
You say they didn't waive the 30-day objection, but the document itself says, you know, expressly entered into this agreement, they consent to this agreement, they release all the parties. I mean, it's got a couple pages of agreement and release, so how could you even argue that they had the right then to object when they didn't appeal it? They didn't object. They didn't appeal it. The matter went forward. Your client remarried. And 3.5 years later, you say, whoa.
Well, Civil Rule 53 says that if there's a magistrate's decision, and I guess that's another issue. I don't know what this is. I don't know if it's a magistrate's decision because the magistrate didn't sign it in her own name. It purports to be a judgment entry decree of divorce, but the judge didn't sign it. The magistrate did, and we all stipulated that the magistrate signed it. Our argument is there's nothing to appeal from because there's no final judgment entry, and the magistrate is not the court. I would respectfully suggest that, yes, there are issues here, although I doubt that there are 4,000 issues or even 700 issues. The only case that I know about where anybody has brought this up is this case in Delaware County. There are no other pending cases that I know about.
But how many, if we agree with your position, and I want to clarify what that is, are you saying it's void or are you saying it's voidable?
I'm saying it's void.
All right. I thought you said earlier that you agreed it was voidable.
No, I'm saying that it's...
Well, if it is void, then if this occurred in any other circumstance, wouldn't those other judgments also be void?
If someone brought it up, there's a presumption that a judgment entry of anything is right and proper until someone goes to the courthouse and says, wait a minute, I think there's something wrong with this. No one else has done this other than my client.
But Ms. Gaba,
so
the
problem is...
So Go ahead, Chief.
The problem is that if we were to rule in your favor, this court could be flooded with requests to declare that to declare entries that were signed years ago. Declare them void. The problem is we're talking about a real concern about res judicata here. If it's a voidable entry and there's no appeal, that's it. Everyone can rely on the entry, whether there was error or not. It's when you say that it's void, you are saying, unless we're talking about criminal cases, which we have partly void, but if it's a civil case and it would be void, it would be a nullity as if it had never occurred, as if the court had no jurisdiction to act, which is very, I mean, that's a serious thing, and allows the parties to collaterally attack the entry at any time.
Well, Civil Rule 58, 250502, they all say that a judgment entry has to be signed by the court.
Counsel, is there a definition of signature in either the civil rule or the statute? Or is this a matter of judicial interpretation as to what signed by the court means?
From what I have investigated, it's a matter of judicial interpretation. I think there's an agreement that signed by the court is signed by the judge because of Article 4 of the Ohio Constitution, that judges are elected. I would argue that in this case, if this court says, well, this is going to cause problems, well, it also causes problems in that what we have here is a case where a judge has abdicated his role as the judge and effectively made a magistrate, or in other circumstances, the bailiff or a secretary
maybe,
of the judge.
Well, maybe. There's no question in this case, if I recall the briefs correctly, that this judge specifically authorized this magistrate to sign when there was an agreed entry. Is that a correct statement of this case?
That's what he put in his affidavit, and he also said he didn't know anything about the case. That was also in his affidavit.
About this case, but that was his practice. He authorized the magistrate to sign his name when there was an agreed entry. I recall another field of law that says a signature of a person is any mark that is authorized by the person, whether they personally sign it or not. Now, I understand we're in a little different field of law, but why wouldn't those principles apply? Maybe not the preferred practice, but why wouldn't they apply if the judge, in fact, authorized the signature?
Because the judge in this case is completely divorced from the act. He's completely out of the picture. He said in his affidavit he knew nothing about the case, which meant he didn't read it. The only time that he was aware, apparently, of this case is when I subpoenaed him as a witness, because I was trying to determine what was going on. This was the first time that I had heard through his testimony by his affidavit that he had authorized the magistrate. What if he authorized his secretary to sign his name? Is that good enough? Is that a final appealable order that someone has 30 days? What if he authorized his bailiff? What if he authorized anybody who's sitting in the courtroom if he knows nothing about the case? He's handing over his job as the judge to someone who has not been elected.
So if he read it and approved it and was in a rush to get out to resume a jury trial and said, here, I approve this, authorize you to sign my name to that, that would be okay? Because
I don't think that's okay either, but that would probably be at least less of an abdication of his role as a judge. If the judges in Ohio are elected, they're not appointed.
But in this case, nobody was objecting to it. In fact, they all took the benefits of it. So isn't this a little bit hypocritical here?
I don't think it's hypocritical. The testimony, and part of that is in my brief and part of it is in previous motions, is that my client testified that she signed any agreement under duress because she stated that Mr. Miller was abusive and she needed to get him out of the house. And I think her testimony was she would have signed anything because she was afraid for herself and she was afraid for her daughter.
Don't you normally deal with those issues on a direct appeal within 30 days?
Well, she didn't, but again, I guess this is a circular argument. There was nothing to appeal from, and that's the issue. If this court says that there's something to appeal from, even if there's no, what if there were no signature?
Okay, if you win this case, if we rule it's void, you understand that you need to go back and advise your client then that the marriage is undone, the second marriage is undone. All the tax returns that were filed from when the first marriage have to be refiled. All the property divisions have to be undone, everything given back. There's a huge consequence to your client from the tail of this decision. You understand that your client is going to have to go back and undo all these things that happened in her life because she's won this case.
I understand that, and she understands that, but I think it's far more significant, really, that judges who are elected are the people who look at the cases and actually sign their entries and not some individual who may or may not work for them.
Well, counsel, are you under the impression that when a judge, especially in domestic relations court where there may be one, two, three, or more magistrates, depending on the volume, that the role of the magistrate is to dispose of the case and the role of the judge in those circumstances is to delegate and to oversee, but not to be intimately involved in the individual cases?
Well,
no sense in having a magistrate and having the magistrate do the responsibilities and the that are attendant to the case, and then the judge duplicate those actions. What's the sense of having the magistrate?
Well, what's the sense of having a judge if the judge is not even looking at the file?
Well, counsel, I want to follow up on that because I take it from what you've said here that you believe every common pleas judge who has a magistrate handling domestic stuff is compelled to read all of the details of the entry that terminates the marriage when the time is run for objecting to the magistrate's report, and the only thing to be done is the mechanical signing of the entry that comports to the magistrate's report and findings. But the judge is supposed to plow through every paragraph of that before his or her signature goes on that.
I would hope that any judge anywhere in Ohio whose job it is to sign a judgment entry, no matter what the judgment entry is, would read it first and then sign it. There's a presumption.
And how would that make sense to them if the judge hadn't been familiar with the case for the pleadings all the way through the judgment entry? I mean, there may be property settlement provisions. Now, how is the judge to evaluate whether that is a good or sufficient property settlement, for example, in a separation agreement?
Well, then why would there be a requirement that the judge sign anything? And also, this is a case, and I would add, Justice, this is a case where there isn't a magistrate's report or findings. There's none of that. There's something that purports to be a judgment entry decree of divorce with the signature of the magistrate, and the signature pretends to be the signature of the judge. So it's not that kind of case that you brought up, Your Honor. Why is there a requirement that that you have to have a judge's signature? Following that your line of argument, why does the judge have to sign anything? Why can't the judge assign every possible kind of case to his employees, to his law clerk or staff attorney, and only deal with perhaps contested issues? Because that's not what it says in the Constitution. Because that's not what the judge is elected to do. Because that's not what Article 4 says.
Well, our decision, one of our tasks here is to determine when a judge designates a magistrate to do signing of a document in light of a agreed-upon entry, whether that is the court acting, the court signing the document. I mean, that's one of the decisions that we'll have to reach, but in addition to, obviously, the proposition we've taken in. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Warnock, you've used all your time. You may take a minute.
I'm sorry?
You've used all your time, but you may take a minute.
Is the issue of delegation of a judge to a magistrate something that you want to comment upon right now?
Because I have just a minute, probably not. The court did not the court did not take that proposition of law. We were prepared to argue, had the court taken the proposition, that in this case, because of the authority that the judge gave, that would have been a proper delegation. Again, because it's lay people viewing this case would view this simply as a mechanical technicality. We as lawyers and you as a Supreme Court need to decide what the law is going to be, but the litigants in these particular cases wanted their divorce, they got their divorce, they don't want it undone. I just don't believe that even opposing counsel's client would want that to happen. I can assure you that folks do not want this to happen. We emphasize in our brief about finality. We prize, as a time-honored principle of our justice system, finality and things we can rely on. In this case, both parties had to go to the proper place in Delaware County to get their marriage license. They had to present this decree for their second marriage and say, I'm now divorced. I would like to get remarried. And yet,
counsel, what about the argument that's been proposed that she was under duress and was the subject of domestic abuse and that's the only reason this document was signed. Has that entered into any of this previously?
First of all, it's not true. But secondly, even if it were true, the court, either as part of the written document, the agreed judgment entry, or when the parties stand up and they're sworn in under oath, they say, I'm entering into this voluntarily, I'm satisfied with all the terms, I've had legal counsel and so forth. And that happened in this case. The Chief Justice, that underlines the point that the defect, if there was a defect, existed at the time. And so if she had signed an agreed judgment entry under duress, she had the opportunity within 30 days to file a direct appeal and say, this whole thing was not done right. The judge didn't sign it. I was under duress. I wasn't satisfied with the terms, whatever the issue is. We just can't have in this state a situation where hundreds and thousands of people have their divorces potentially undone. One more point, if I may. There is no authority, none, for the proposition that this type of defective signature or even delegation of power makes a case void. The only applicable precedent of this court last year, they just did away in that case with the Rule 53 procedures, and this court said it wasn't the right thing to do, but we're not going to render these divorce case nullities. The only cases that are void are ones where the court didn't have jurisdiction over the case or authority to act. Otherwise, we're dealing with voidable issues. And so the precedents that our Fifth District Court of Appeals inexplicably ignored, including one from the Fifth District, the Beal case, say that these types of problems create voidable, not void orders.
Thank you.
And our criminal cases should not impact on this at all, in your view. The criminal cases that expand the term void.
It's an inside joke.
Okay.
Yeah, it is.
She's talking to us, not you.
Right.
We're not listening.
She was looking at me. I didn't know that. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.
Good try.